right. As I've been indicating, Revelation chapter 20 is a difficult chapter. Probably, in my mind, it's the most difficult chapter in the entire Bible. Personally, I believe that Revelation is probably the most difficult book in the entire Bible. Now, some of those minor prophets that Mike Cantrell likes may be just as difficult, or some may say are even more difficult, but in my mind, Revelation is very difficult. And then when you get to chapter 20 is extremely difficult. I'm just going to tell you right now. If you're expecting me to give you a real easy understanding of chapter 20, I'm not sure I can, other than the basic message. There's a lot of symbols in here. And there's a lot of symbols. And the way that John has set up this this chapter really kind of helps to make it a little bit more difficult. And we'll see that here as we're going through it. And then when you add in all of the worldly teachings that go on with chapter 20 by people that don't try to understand it in light of the Old Testament, in light of the first century, and what the Christians of that time, whom the book was written to, were going through, and understand that this is all for them, it becomes even more difficult, even more challenging. And I indicated several weeks back that over the past 20 years, I've kind of come to a different it's an understanding of chapter 20, and I never taught it this way, and I'm about to teach it today differently than I've ever taught it, and next week. So this is just I'm kind of hesitant. Earlier this week, I went through my PowerPoint, changed it, sent it to Kevin, went over it again, changed it, sent it to Kevin, and then yesterday morning, went over it again, changed it, and sent it again to Kevin. And last night as I was going over it, I made a few more changes, but I didn't send it to Kevin. We'll just go with what I got here at this time. It's just hopefully we'll be able to present it in a way that is that you understand the main idea and the thoughts of chapter 20 and not muddy the waters even more. In chapter 20, you have one message, and it's presented by two different points. And we're going to go over the message and the points here in just a second. But understand that chapter 20 is a culmination of what he's been talking about in beginning about chapter 16, which is the destruction of all the enemies of the Christians of that first century and what they were going through. The harlot, the city of Rome, materialism is destroyed. The two beasts in chapter 19 were destroyed, that is, thrown into the lake of fire. Now, the last enemy of those Christians would be the leader of the two beasts. The one that initiated the vast wealth and materialism on this with the city of Rome is got to be defeated. And that's what chapter 20 is about. Christ's ultimate victory. And in order to have an ultimate victory, you have to have a defeat of the leader. And that's what we're going to see in these first 10 verses. And then beginning in verse 11, he continues with that idea and discusses his truly final ultimate victory, which is the day of judgment. But we'll get to that in just a second. This intertwining of the points in the first 10 verses makes it extraordinarily dense. And I'm getting ahead of myself. But if you look at verses 1 through 3, and then 7 through 10, it's all on the same topic. Verses 4 through 6 is a different topic, per se. And so, but it's the same idea, so he kind of combines these two. So we're going to see that here in just a second, and I'll point that out to you. But it makes it very, the argument, or makes the point he's making very dense and hard to unpack. So let's start unpacking this. Okay, first thing I want to talk about are things not mentioned in chapter 20. As I said, there's a lot of error taught on chapter 20. So I want to get started, first of all, with what's not there. Christ's second coming is not in this chapter. His second coming is not in this chapter. Okay? His coming in judgment is. And that's what we've seen in chapters 16 through 19. But if you go over to Acts chapter 1, verses 9 through 11, when he was taken up into the clouds, Now when he had spoken these things, while they watched, he was taken up, and a cloud received him out of their sight. And while they looked steadfastly toward heaven, as he went up, behold, two men stood by them in white apparel, who also said, Men of Galilee, why do you stand gazing up into heaven? The same Jesus who was taken up from you into heaven will so come in like manner as you saw him go into heaven. He's going to come back in a cloud. He's not going to come back with his armies. He's coming back in a cloud. Now, he comes in judgment with his armies, which we've already seen in chapter 19. But that's different from what this angel told the apostles in Acts chapter 1 and is recorded for us. This is not his second coming. Also, there's no physical rain on earth. You can't show me anywhere in chapter 20 where it's talking about earth. It's not there. If you take a look at chapter 20, we're going to see we're in heaven. There's no physical rain mentioned anywhere or even implied in chapter 20. Nor is there a bodily resurrection. Now, I will say that there are resurrections all over the place in chapter 20. I mean, when we get to verses 4 through 6 are the hardest three verses in the entire Bible. And there are like four different, no, it's an overstatement. There are two different resurrections mentioned there. And then when you get down in verses 11 through 15, there's another resurrection mentioned there. They're all different. But it's not a bodily, none of these are a bodily resurrection. There's nothing in there that would imply it or even give that idea. And notice finally, and this is most important, look at verse 4. I saw thrones, and they sat on them, and judgment was committed to them. Then I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus and for the word of God, who had not worshipped the beast or his image and had not received his mark on their foreheads or on their hands. And they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. They, not us. And John even goes so far as to identify who they are. Who's the they that chapter 20 is talking about here in these verses? Who's the they? The ones that were beheaded. You want to be one of those? What do you have to do? You have to be beheaded. And as we're going to see here in a second, you go back to chapter 6, verses 9 through 10. Those who had been persecuted for the cause of Christ were where? Under the altar. And where was the altar? In heaven. And they had, and they're asking how long. This is whom we're talking about in this chapter. Those in chapter 6, verses 9 and 10, and we'll talk more about this. But we need to understand, this is not, verses 1 through 10 is not about us. It's about these folks. Folks in chapter 6, 9 and 10, those that have been persecuted for the cause of Christ. That's who's under discussion in this chapter. But we want to throw ourselves in there. I don't think we can, because that's John identifies who this is being addressed to and who is being talked about. Now, this next part I added, change, sent. I don't want to muddy the water here, but this is, in my mind, very important to understanding chapter 20. Chapter 20 must be looked at in terms of one message presented by two different points or two different discussions as given in the first 10 verses, and it concludes in verses 11 through 15. The one message is Christ's complete victory. That's easy. He is complete, completely victorious. But you also have two points of discussion in verses 1 through 10. And when you break those two apart, it's a little bit easier to understand. But if you don't understand, there are two different points, two different discussions taking place in verses 1 through 10, then you have some difficulties. Verses 1 through 3 and 7 through 10, what about Satan? That's what John's talking about. Satan and his final total defeat. His defeat in the first century with the use of the Roman Empire and the two beasts, the city of Rome and the two beasts, and then his ultimate defeat in verse 10 is what's talked about. He's going to tell us about Satan. Then you get to verses 4 through 6, and there's a question that he has been dealing with, and he's going to specifically deal with it and answer it. What about the saints who died during the persecutions of the first century? What about them? What's going to happen to them? Where are they at? He answers that here in verses 4 through 6. Okay? And so we need to understand that there are two discussions to show the one point true. The second point is that there's going to be a resurrection of causes. And I know we're going to talk about the binding of Satan for the 1,000 years and all of that. And we're going to take a look at what, going back to Ezekiel and taking a look at other passages to understand what he's talking about here. But I don't believe these are literal resurrections that he's talking about based on the Old Testament. It's actually a resurrection of a cause. Cause for those that persecute Christ and his kingdom will be resurrected, not with the city of Rome or the two beasts, but with other allies of Satan. And he talks about them as being Gog and Magog. And we'll talk about that when we get there as well. He has other allies that he uses down through the centuries and will continue to use. They will be defeated, but there will be other allies that will rise up with Satan. And he will use them as well. And then there's the resurrection of the cause of the faithful. There will always be that. So there's a couple of resurrection of causes, and we'll talk about that in a second. This is just an introduction. So both points are found in verses 1 through 10, and this presents the one message of chapter 20. Whew. I hope we have a general idea of what's going on. Let's get into first point. And I'm going to read verses 1 through 3. Leave out 4 through 6 and then 7 through 10 because I believe this is the first discussion that he wants to have, and he answers the question, what about Satan, in these 6 verses. And I think you'll see how these verses just kind of go together. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. And he cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal on him so that he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years were finished. But after these things, he must be released for a little while. Now when the 1,000 years have expired, Satan will be released from his prison and will go out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, whose number is as the sand of the sea. They went up on the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints in the beloved city. And fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. The devil who deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone where the beast and the false prophet are, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. Do you see how this is one message? It just kind of goes right with one when you take out verses 4 through 6, because he's answering the next question, what about the saints that were persecuted and died? In verses 4 through 6. So we're going to take that out. We're going to look at that probably next week. But you see how verses 1 through 3 and 7 through 10, it's one idea that he is presenting. It is one message. And he's answering the question, what about Satan? So let's work our way through this. If you have questions, please answer them. I don't know how much I'm going to say, what do you think, in this chapter, because I don't know how much I'm going to ask that, because this is such a difficult chapter. So let's continue on. Then I saw an angel come down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. I will ask questions, though. Have we seen this key before? We've seen it twice before. Do you remember where we've seen it? Who had it early in the book? Christ. And I'm going to show you here in a second. I think it's chapter 1. And then who has it later in the book? Satan, because Christ gave it to him. But the key now has been taken away. And who has the key here? An angel. All right? An angel. So Christ had the key in chapter 1 of verse 18, then given it to Satan in 9:1 through 8. Now it's been taken from Satan and given to an angel. What does that indicate, that it's been taken from Satan and given to an angel? What's the idea that's being presented here? Yeah, he's limited on his power. He is not unlimited. He can't do whatever he wants to us. Have we seen that in the Old Testament? Where did we see that really specifically said to us in the Old Testament? Job. Yeah, He was limited by Satan in the book of Job. He said, you can do this up to this point, but no more. And then Satan comes back and says, he will curse you if you do this. And he said, go ahead, but do not take his life. He is limited. Is he still limited today with us? Is there a passage in the New Testament that gives the idea that he is limited in what he's able to do with us? Where's that at? 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 13. Absolutely. He says that we will not be tempted above that which we are able to be tempted. Satan's limited. Satan is limited in his power, and he's limited by God, which is an indication that God is in control. It may not seem like it. And we've already talked about that a lot. Those Christians in the first century had a hard time. And I could just imagine that they were wondering, there were many times they were talking and probably wondering, who is in control? People still do that today when they're going through hardships. We don't say who is in control, but how do we ask that? How do we ask that question? Why? How could you allow this to happen? You know, God's in control. We may not understand why things happen, but we have to believe in the fact that they happen because that's what God wants to have happen for whatever reason. And he uses that to his benefit and our benefit. He laid hold on the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. Now, is the 1,000 years literal? Do you think the 1,000 years is literal? No, I don't believe it is literal. Again, the way we understand Revelation is different from the way we understand the rest of the Bible. You take a look at everything, and you look at it as symbolic until you're forced to look at it as literal. This is not literal. It's not 1,000 years. Let me give you show you how that this 1,000, and 1,000 is just 10 to the third powers, to be understood as a symbol of completeness. Turn back to Deuteronomy chapter 7 and verse 9 if you want to. I have it here up on the PowerPoint. But in Deuteronomy chapter 7 and verse 9, Moses says, therefore know that the Lord your God, He is God, the faithful God who keeps covenant and mercy for 1,000 generations with those who love Him and keep His commandments. Does that mean after 1,000 generations, God doesn't have to be faithful and loyal anymore to us? Is that what He's saying? So now how is 1,000 generations used here? Yeah, it's forever. It's just a complete number. It's used the exact same way. If you say it's a literal 1,000 years in Revelation chapter 20, I am going to say you have to look at Deuteronomy chapter 7 and verse 9 and say it's literal there as well. And after 1,000 generations, God doesn't have to be faithful anymore. So God is not God if that's the case. But we know He is God. This is just meaning complete long time. And so it's going to be a specific time period that Satan is going to be bound, not for a literal 1,000 years. Now, he's going to be bound from doing something, as we're going to see. And in the context of the book of Revelation, I think we can understand that he's going to be bound, as we're going to see here in a second in the next verse, from deceiving the nations. How was he deceiving the nations in the first, second, third century before Rome fell? How was he deceiving the nations in the book of Revelation? What was going on to get them to, what was he using to deceive the nations? Three things. All right, so you had the city of Rome, represented in chapter 16 as a harlot, materialism. Now, he's bound, but we're going to see he's going to be loosed, and he still uses materialism. But what does this mean he's not going to be able to use then? The city of Rome. What else did he use to deceive the nations? He used the Roman government. It's the land, sea beast. And that was destroyed in chapter 19. And there's one other thing that he used to deceive the nations. If you remember. the sea beast, the lion beast, which is representatory of the false worship of Caesar. He deceived the nations. And he's going to be bound, and he's not going to be able to use those things any longer. But as we're going to see in verse 8, it doesn't mean that he doesn't deceive the nations any longer. He just won't be able to use those allies any longer to deceive the nations. He has other allies to do that with, though, because there's always going to be allies with him as long as the earth remains. And let me just point out, if this is a literal binding, sin would not be occurring. If it was literal. It's not literal, it's symbolic. And it's symbolic, as we're going to see here, as I've already indicated. And he cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal on him so that he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years were finished. But after these things, he must be released for a little while. As I've already indicated, the binding is not literal. And I think the binding is in reference to the topics of the book, emperor worship, persecutions of Christians through the Roman Empire, and use of the city of Rome with this materialism. But then he says something very interesting here, and we're going to talk about it for just a few moments. And that is, he's going to be loosed again. He's going to be loosed again for a little while. But after these things, he must be released. He still deceives through worship of false gods, and he still persecutes, but no more, as I've already indicated, with his two allies. Why or how is Satan released? And what do you suppose is restraining him when he is restrained? I want you to think about that for a few moments. What do you think? That's what John's saying. There are times when he's bound and he's not deceiving the nations, and then there are times when he is loosed and he's able to deceive the nations. Now, I've always said, and I'll just kind of preface that while you're thinking, the United States of America is not a Christian country. I'm sorry. It is not a Christian, never has been in my mind. Not like New Testament Christianity. You may say it was a religious country. I would agree with that, but it was never a first century Christian country, ever has it been. But it has been a lot more religious at times. Would you say we are less or more religious from 100 years ago? Less. I think we're being. I think this nation is being deceived. So he might be bound for a little while, and then he's loose. What binds and what looses, do you suppose? God? Possibly. What do you think?
To him is going to determine, isn't it, how much Satan is able to deceive us?
Think about the passage. Yeah, I think you're right. I'm going to segue off your comments here. Think about the passages in the New Testament as to what Christians are to a nation. What are Christians to a nation? We are salt and light. What happens when the salt loses its flavor? It's cast out. The light grows weak. What cannot the world see? Can't see the light. Can't see Christ. Can't see God. So I'll just go back 75 years to the 1950s. I want you to think about the 1950s and what you've heard, for many of us, what you heard, for some of you, what you lived through in the 1960s. How strong was the church in the 50s and 60s? 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. How strong was the church? You had a visitor come. I'm told you had a visitor come to the services that was not a Christian. And you know what everybody did? Greeted and then taught. Homer Haley has this to say. And I find it very interesting. Haley suggests that, quote, the spirit and loyal devotion of the martyrs had bound Satan by overcoming him. When such a spirit and loyal devotion to the principles and cause of Christ no longer distinguish God's people, the restraining power is gone, Satan is loosed once more to deceive. So within a country, when the church is strong, actively involved, converting, separating themselves, allowing people just to look and see that there's a difference between us and the world, he is bound. But when the Christians lose their flavor and the light grows dim, other New Testament passages. Yeah, when Christians compromise, he is then free. He is then free, made freer to deceive the nations. I don't know if that's the case, 100%. But it sure seems that way to me. And I could be wrong, but it sure seems that way to me. And it's something interesting to think about as well, about all of this. Which would indicate that we have what? We have a responsibility, first of all, and power. Yeah, responsibility for what? What's that?
Work,
teaching. The class on Wednesday night. This comes into play with that. We have a responsibility to make sure we look at the way we dress. We look at the things we're spending our money on. We look at what we're doing, what we're saying, how we're... One person can make a huge difference in the world, in a country. I just kind of throw that out there for you to think about. Interesting what Haley had to say here concerning that. And will go out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, whose number is as the sand of the sea. When Satan is able to deceive again, guess what? He will deceive. And what does he also say? What does verse 8 also say? When he goes out to deceive, what else is he going to have? He's going to have other allies. Now, have we seen these allies mentioned before? Again, go back. You have to understand the Old Testament to understand the book of Revelation. If you don't understand the Old Testament, brethren, you're not going to understand the book of Revelation, and you're going to be going in so many different places with the book of Revelation. Have we seen Gog anywhere else in the Bible? Ezekiel. If you want to turn over to Ezekiel chapter 37 and 38, we're going to go over Gog and Magog right now. Excuse me, chapter 38 and 39. Gog from the land of Magog is how he's referenced in chapters 38 and 39 of Ezekiel. We have seen him before, and now we're seeing him again. And the way he is presented, what is said about him in these verses, is also, I believe, very important for us understanding Revelation chapter 20 when he talks about Gog and Magog. I'm going to turn there. I don't have the verses up here, but we're going to go through several verses in Ezekiel 38 and 39. So let me turn over there very quickly. But you'll notice, Gog of the land of Magog was a prince of the countries of the north. Notice verse 2. Son of man, set thy face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him. So he was a prince of the countries of the north, and he would command an army that would invade Israel. Look at verses 6 through 9. Gomer and all his bands, the house of Togarmah of the north quarters, and all his bands, and many people with thee. Be thou prepared, and prepare for thyself, thou and all thy company that are assembled unto thee, and be thou guard unto them. After many days thou shalt be visited. In the latter years thou shalt come into the land that is brought back from the sword, and is gathered out of many people against the mountains of Israel, which have been always waste, but it is brought forth out of the nations, and they shall dwell safely, all of them. And they shall ascend and come like a storm. Thou shalt be like a cloud to cover the land, thou and all thy bands, and many people with thee. And we're going to see here in just a second that this is not a literal person, but it's a symbolic person again. But I'm going to reference him as a literal person until we get to that part. But he is going to be commanding an army and invading Israel. And he's going to do it with the intention of taking spoils for himself. Verses 10 through 13. Thus saith the Lord God, it shall also come to pass that at the same time shall things come into thy mind, and thou shalt think an evil thought, and thou shalt say, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages. I will go to them that are at rest, that dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates, to take a spoil and to take a prey, to turn thine hand upon the desolate places that are now inhabited, and upon the people that are gathered out of the nations, which have gotten cattle and goods, and dwell in the midst of the land. So he's going to be a conqueror. He's going to be a conqueror, and he's going to be taking things that he wants. And he would continue in verse 16 of chapter 38 until the latter days. And thou shalt come up against many people of Israel as a cloud to cover the land. It shall be in the latter days, and I will bring thee against my land, that the heathen may know him, when I shall be sanctified in thee, O Gog, before thy eyes. So it's going to be continuing into the messianic period, and he would be utterly destroyed and totally destroyed, to where the birds would gorge on his carcasses of his army. Chapter 39. Have we seen that before? In the book of Revelation, where the birds gorged on all of his, on the enemies of God's, the bodies of the enemies of God? Yeah, we saw that last week and the week before. He calls for the birds of prey to come. But still continuing with Gog of Magog, and this will help us to understand how he's used, how they're used in the book of Revelation. God explains who Gog and Magog are. He said he had spoken of him in the prophets of old. Notice verse 17 of 38. Thus saith the Lord God, art thou he of whom I have spoken in old time by my servants and prophets of Israel, which prophesied in those days many years that I would bring thee against them? So God says, I have prophesied about Gog of the land of Magog in the prophets. Where else is Gog and Magog mentioned in the prophets? That's the correct answer. He's not. You can't find Gog anywhere else other than here in Revelation chapter 20. But the prophets had predicted that heathen armies would come against Israel and be defeated by God. What are some of the heathen armies that came against Israel and defeated them? Who? You're mumbling, but you know the answer. The Philistines, Midianites, Babylonians, Assyrians. They were all brought, and did they take spoils? Yes, they did. Were they ultimately defeated by the hand of God? Yes, they were. So hence, these are, and I believe that's who's being talked about in this verse, is that all these other countries that were prophesied about coming against Israel, these are those that are represented by Gog from the land of Magog. So hence, we conclude that Gog of the land of Magog symbolizes all the heathen armies of God's people from the time of the prophets to the Roman Empire. All who sought to thwart God's purposes and to destroy his king and his kingdom. And you know what? Every single one of them have been the allies of Satan. And every single one of them still today are the allies of Satan. So we'll go back to Revelation chapter 20. Homer Haley says this, rather than a literal battle, this symbolizes a moral and spiritual conflict. Satan uses atheism, heathenism, communism, materialism, astrology, and all manner of false and perverted religions to deceive men today. He also uses anarchy, rebellion against all principles and standards of truth. And I just kind of point out to you, have we seen that in this country recently? And are we still seeing it? Just kind of throw that out there to think about. Corruption in business and government, do we see that? And immorality of all kinds. Satan uses the anti-God immoral standards and practices he is using today. Thus, Satan is deceiving today and will continue to deceive until the end. He has his allies. Gog and Magog are his allies. Now, are they going to be different through the period of history, time period of history? Absolutely. And is it going to be different in different countries? One country, it may be this ally. One country, it may be another ally that's not over here. Absolutely. But he is attacking God's people and the church, and he has allies to do that very thing. That's what he said. He's going to be released, and he will continue to attack God's kingdom, and he will continue to have allies. And they went up on the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints in the beloved city. And fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. God, though, will always defend his people. He's going to defend his people. Okay? He's going to defend his people. The unrighteous will never be totally, and I should have, will never be totally successful. They're going to have some successes. There are Christians that are going to fall away because of his allies, because of materialism. There are going to be Christians that are not going to be faithful after so many years. He will have success, but there will not be a total success. He will not ever destroy the kingdom of Christ. He will try, but it will never happen. Book of Daniel tells us that. Book of Daniel shows that to be the case beyond a shadow of a doubt. His kingdom will be like that huge boulder that destroys all other kingdoms. But they will have some success. Every attack to destroy the church will be repulsed. That's what's being said in this verse. Up to this point, it looks like it's pretty scary, you know, for Christians. But we get to verse 9 and 10, and we see the ultimate victory of Christ. First, he's going to defend us. And he will not allow his kingdom to be destroyed. It will not be totally destroyed ever. Now, this camp in the city, I have no clue. I'll just be honest with you. The camp of the saints and the beloved city. I think the beloved city is Jerusalem, New Jerusalem. And in Hebrews, what is Jerusalem? What is the New Jerusalem today in this time period? The church or the kingdom. And what's the church or the kingdom composed of? Us. It's not a literal building. It's not a literal city that's walled in. It's the people. So you have reference to the camp of the saints and the beloved city. The beloved city is the people. I have no clue what the camp of the saints are. Maybe he's emphasizing it twice. I don't know. But it's interesting, but when you look at it that way, I don't know what he's referencing here as the camp of the saints. But regardless, God's people, the point of this is that God's people will be defeated. They will be, and that Satan will not be successful. Questions or comments up to this point? Take 10 years and think about this. Take 20 years and think about this. This chapter is just totally in-depth in so many ways. The devil who deceived, now we're going to see the enemy. And this, I have to believe that the Christians in the first century, and remember, I went over this back in the first week of this class, and I'm going to remind us this is what those Christians were going through. They were being used as human candles. They were dipped in hot wax. And then they were lit to light the gardens of Caesar. Christians were. They were thrown into the lion's den. But you know what kind of interesting here? They were thrown into the lion's den, but that didn't go on for very long. And the reason why, the Roman historians tell us this. You know why they didn't throw the Christians to the lions for very long? Yeah, because the Christians weren't what? They weren't afraid. They literally sat in the middle of the Colosseum and sang praises to God. They had no fear. So guess what the lions didn't do? They didn't attack. And the soldiers had to go out. You read the Roman histories. The soldiers had to go out and kill them with a sword. Because it wasn't fun. It wasn't sport for those that had gathered together to see the Christians ripped apart. So it didn't go on for very long. But there was another practice that they used. And I mentioned this earlier because it, to me today, this is a very, very, this temptation, it would be a very strong temptation. Where the Romans would find Christians, they'd go into the house, they would take their children, they would take their grandchildren, they'd have wild dogs that they hadn't fed for a long period of time. They would wrap them in animal skins, and then they would look at the adults and they would say, deny Christ, or you're going to watch your grandchildren and your children be ripped apart by these animals. And I don't know about you, but that would be a hard temptation for me. And I'm thankful that I don't have to face that. Never faced it to this point. And I pray I never will. That would be a difference. To see Jackson or Eli or Grayson or Briley or Evelyn, and to know that if I didn't deny Christ, they were going to be ripped apart by wild animals. You know what they'd want to know, those Christians of the first century would want to know? What about Satan? What's going to happen to him? The one who's behind all of this. And you can say, well, we should not be vengeful. Those Christians under the altar, in chapter 6, verses 9 and 10, read it. They were not vengeful, but they wanted justice. And that's what I would want in the first century. And I believe that's what those Christians wanted. What about Satan? Verse 10. The devil who deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone where the beast and the false prophet are, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. It will come to an end one day. Satan will be ultimately defeated, and he will suffer for all eternity because of all the suffering that he unleashed on God's people. The final defeat of Satan is shown to the Christians. And I believe it's shown so that they will know he will not always be victorious. And even he one day will face the wrath of God. We can be assured of that fact. He will be completely defeated one day. And he will not be able to rise up again and hurt God's people. Karen. And then he cast him out into the sea.
He said, well, are you going to have to torment me before my time?
Yep. Good point. Yeah. And then he sent him out. So that's the first question. What about Satan? And next week, it'll take a whole three verses. We'll take the whole class period, and I hope we get it done in one class period. Because let me tell you, these three verses are the three toughest verses of any three verses in the entire Bible in my mind. You can get lost. There are so many resurrections taking place in these three verses, and so much that's talked about in these three verses, and we can get lost. So we're going to take our time and go through those three verses. But the message of these three verses, very powerful. And then we'll skip down to verse 11 through 15 and continue with that and can ultimately see Christ's ultimate victory. So next week, we'll start with chapter 20 and verse 4 and hopefully finish chapter 20 next week. Thank you for your comments. And if you have questions, Jim Smeltzer will answer all of your questions in Revelation chapter 20 after this class.